This is Central Time. Now there are two ways to cook. Actually, there are a lot of different ways to cook, but let's pretend there's just two. One, learn the rules, follow the rules. Two, make it up as you go. But hold on, our next guest says you can do both if we use cooking rules that unleash our creativity instead of tying it down. Christopher Kimball is founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, which includes a national TV show and radio show, a magazine, and a cooking school. Milk Street Radio airs here on the Ideas Network Sundays at 10 a.m. His new book is called Milk Street, The New Rules, Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. Christopher Kimball, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. By the way, that was a terrific description of Milk Street. Really well done.
Thank you. We'll talk about this idea of new rules. Why did you want to tackle cooking in this way?
Well, I'd grown up, as a lot of people did, with Northern European rules, right? Mostly French cooking, English cooking, et cetera, a little bit of pseudo-Italian. And the basic concept is take fairly bland ingredients, time, heat, and technique to develop flavor, like a beef bourguignon, right? That makes a lot of sense for that part of the world. But if you travel the world, you realize that other people in other cultures have totally different sets of rules. They use water, not stock. They undercook their pasta and finish it in the sauce. They don't saute their meat before making a stew. And a lot of these techniques are smarter. That is, they get food on the table faster, and you get big, bold flavors because they tend to use big, bold ingredients, spices, handfuls of herbs, soy sauce, et cetera. So it turned out, I'm not saying it's a better way to cook, but there are just other ways to cook, many of which actually are better given the amount of time and effort we can spend in the kitchen these days.
Now, it was hazardous, Christopher, when I was going through the book at the workplace. There were all these sounds of my head exploding as I read these rules and realized these great ways to do things differently, some really simple. I want to dive into some of these and talk about them. Now, I'm an okay cook. I'm really surprisingly bad at making interesting salads. I love this. You've got a bunch of rules for salads. I love this one. To get the dressing to stick to vegetables, you salt the vegetables in your salad just a little bit. What?
Well, salting obviously adds flavor. It also draws some of the water out. For example, if you salt eggplant, you know, for example, and let that drain, a lot of the water comes out. So if some of the water comes out, then it'll absorb the dressing. I think, you know, it's really key. It's why you undercook pasta and finish it in the sauce. The pasta absorbs the sauce. So getting the flavor into the vegetables is really key.
And the dressing is actually going to stick to it better? Because I've had that, like, I've got my carrots or whatever, my salad, and the dressing just doesn't fit into it somehow.
It does. And the other thing to keep in mind, the thing that really blew my mind was, you know, I grew up with the 3-to-1 ratio of oil to vinegar, right? And we argue for years about whether it's 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, you know. In a lot of places, when they dress the salad, they'll just use oil, or they'll just use vinegar, or they'll use something else. This whole idea of some rule around how to make a dressing is absurd. There's a million ways to do it. And you don't have to worry about this whole thing about the emulsion and, you know, making sure the oil and water cling together. And, you know, that's a lot of time wasted. What you really want is a good tasting dressing. Salting will absolutely help it cling to the vegetables or whatever. But there's a million ways to do it. You know, a lot of places will use something a little bit of sweetener dressing or something a little bit spicy. Or they use totally different ingredients. And that's just a great example of freeing you up to get away from this very narrow thing, you know, shallots, vinegar, salt, and oil. Well, there's 10,000 other ways to think about it.
Here's another one I thought was really interesting. We're making pasta. We take the dried pasta and we toast it up a little bit first before we start, you know, cooking with it. What does that do?
Yeah, you can do that in a lot of things. You can toast flour, for example. When we make chocolate chip cookies, we toast the flour. Toasting fideos is a recipe that does that. Toasting pasta gives it a more flavor and a slightly different texture, but essentially enhances the flavor. I mean, pastas, I was just in Bologna, actually, in September. And when you go to Italy, you'd think by now that we know everything there is to know, right, about Italian cooking. But that's not true. You know, the ragu bolognese, for example, doesn't use any dairy, you know, in Bologna. The way they make pesto is totally different than the way we make it here. So those little tricks, they're still there, and I guess still undiscovered.
And I mentioned a couple of really specific rules, two out of the, I think, 75 you have in the book. But I think they're great examples because looking through these, none of them are hard. None of these are like really complicated techniques.
Well, look, everybody, if you travel around the world and go into people's homes, not restaurants, everybody has the same problem, if you want to call it that, which is putting food on the table at least once a day. I don't think it's a problem because I like to cook. But the fact of the matter is everybody, whether in Oaxaca or if you're in Beirut or if you're in Taipei, you're still trying to put dinner on the table. And, you know, you have more time or less time, but you're using the local ingredients, but you still figure out the best way to do it. What's so interesting is when you cook with people, first of all, you get to know them pretty quickly, even if they speak Mandarin and you don't. And secondly, you always learn something. You know, there's something they do that's different that you go like, why didn't I think of that? And so it is easier. And the trick is, you know, my mother, I think she bought her spices in the early Eisenhower administration. You know, and by the time Reagan came along, we still had them. So, and she had four spices, right? So just having some spices, just having, using lots of herbs, you know, a cup of herbs instead of a tablespoon, having a few items in the pantry, you know, a soy sauce or a fish sauce, a few other things. Pomegranate molasses is very much like, you know, any kind of molasses. You're boiling down the syrup, the juice of pomegranates. That's a nice thing to have. Just a few things. And you can completely change the way you cook because you begin with big flavors, right? And then in a very short amount of time, you end with big flavors. For example, a stir fry in Thailand, right, will start with big flavors and you cook it in 3 or 4 minutes and you end with big flavors. So I think French cooking doesn't start with big flavors. You know, mastering the art of French cooking didn't use a lot of spices. But if you do have those big flavors to start with, the cooking is less important because you already have the flavors there. You don't have to develop them slowly.
We're talking to Christopher Kimball of Milk Street about the new book, The New Rules, Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. And they will. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Christopher Kimball about you know, easy ideas to add a lot to your cooking? Do you have something you've learned or stumbled across on your own, a simple step that makes a particular dish or type of cooking way better? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Christopher Kimball is with us from Milk Street sharing ideas from the new book, The New Rules, Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Christopher Kimball about easy ways to liven up a particular dish or vice versa? Some advice for us on something that you've discovered that adds a lot of zest. Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I'm excited to tell you I did something no one's ever done before, and that is pesto, a good basil pesto, on my tuna fish sandwich. I put it on the bread, and then I put the tuna salad on there with lettuce and tomato. It was delicious.
Sounds great, Jeff. Thank you so much for that, Christopher. And that sounds like an example of what you were talking about, adding that big flavor to your dish right at the end.
Yeah, I don't think anybody in Italy has ever done that, so he's right. That is an absolute first for pesto. But, you know, why not? You know, pesto when made well in Italy, the basil leaves are a little smaller and stronger, and they don't use a lot of olive oil. They use the pasta cooking water to make it into a sauce. But it is very strongly flavored with basil, more so than here. And that's great. You know, it's just a big flavor. And, you know, I know recipes where you might use 2 cups of basil, right, in a salad. I mean, you can make a salad, for example, all with herbs. You can use parsley, cilantro, basil, et cetera. And you don't even need lettuce. And that's one way to have big flavor, sure.
Jeff, thanks for that call. An eternal struggle here, Chris, in Wisconsin in the winter is the tomatoes we can get at the store, not necessarily the most attractive or tasty. You've got advice. One of your rules is how to get more flavor out of those wintertime grocery tomatoes. What do we do?
This was inspired by Yotam Ottolenghi in his book, Simple. You can take cherry tomatoes or any tomatoes and cook them down with about 1/4 cup olive oil. Start with a little onion. Saute it for a few minutes, then maybe 2 pints or 1.5 pints of tomatoes, quarter cup olive oil and maybe a third of a cup of water. You know, this is the case when oil and water do mix. And the water allows you to cook it more slowly, and you get this wonderful, intense tomato flavor. They do this a lot in the Middle East and other places, in Italy as well. It's just a concentrated tomato, and you can use that as a wonderful sauce on pasta, or you can use it lots of other ways. But cooking tomatoes with oil and water slowly over 25, 30 minutes will, even with the cherry tomatoes out of the supermarket in February, you get a really, really nice sauce. It's just magic.
Time to bring on another caller. I think Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
I'm bowing down to you and giving you accolades in some kind of an Eastern tradition at the moment. I just wanted to say thank you for your show and that you are so giving to all of the guests on your show, and you're not arrogant at all, and I think it's wonderful. I was a table captain at a five-star French restaurant, and so my traditional cooking experience is in French food. And I did something about a month ago that is rather impressive but not difficult to do. I can't eat the ham in the store, and besides that, it's sort of blasé. And so I brined and rubbed and smoked a ham. And it is so amazingly wonderful. And it isn't hard to do. This is not a difficult process. People think that cooking is hard. And there are certain things that a neophant shouldn't probably tackle, like croissant or something like that. But it's not hard. And Rob, you know what? You keep saying that you're like afraid of things. Stop being afraid of food. It's like, if you mess it up, you mess it up. Feed it to the dog. You know, like, don't, like, be afraid to try things. I'm the person that gave you the fennel advice.
That's right. Chris, thank you so much for calling in. And Christopher, there are some foods that, yeah, if they're expensive or I don't know how to cook them, I do get a bit scared of. And maybe you can give us some inspiration for, you know, those borderline foods. You're like, maybe I could cook that, but I don't know. Give us some inspiration on tackling those.
Well, Marion Cunningham, who rewrote the Fanny Farmer books in the 70s, she worked with James Beard. She used to give cooking classes at her home outside of San Francisco, Walnut Creek. And she found that the number one problem with people was fear of failure. And so I know a lot of people who teach classes. And the first thing they do is to absolutely destroy a dish. Like they'll grill a piece of fish and just torch it.
Oh, no.
And then everyone relaxes. You have a beer and you go like, you know, that's the worst case. Now let's go do it. Yeah, just don't worry about it. I mean, people are so grateful if you invite them over and cook for them. My second piece of advice would be cook three things, not eight things. You know, keep it simple. And the third thing is don't tell them what it is until you finish cooking it. Especially desserts. So, you know, I've cooked a lot of cakes that turned into puddings and other things. So it's how you describe the food that really will save you at the end of the day.
That's a great place to leave it. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my great pleasure. Thanks.
That's Christopher Kimball of Milk Street. We talked to him today about the new Milk Street cookbook. It's called The New Rules, Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. You can hear more from Christopher. Milk Street Radio airs here on the Ideas Network Sundays at 10 a.m. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is investigating another officer-involved shooting at a high school, this time in Oshkosh. Police say a student with a weapon confronted a school resource officer at Oshkosh West this morning. They haven't released many details. They say there were gunshots and both the officer and student were injured. The school was placed on lockdown, as were all the middle schools in the city. That incident comes a day after an officer-involved shooting at Waukesha West High School. Police there say a 17-year-old student pulled a gun in a classroom and refused to put it down. The school resource officer called for backup. When they arrived, the student pointed the gun at police officers. One responding officer then shot him. No one died and no one else was injured in either incident. Districts around the state are revisiting their safety and security measures to prevent a tragedy from happening in their schools. David Perodin is a professor in the School of Education at Viterbo University in La Crosse, a former school administrator and author of the book School of Errors, Rethinking School Safety in America. He's host of the Safety Doc podcast. His website is safetyphd.com. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thank you for having me back on Central Time.
And what's your reaction to these two officer-involved shootings, not what we would think about in the mass shooting category, obviously, in schools?
Absolutely. Well, this is stunning. It brings much anxiety to Wisconsin, frightened students, parents, and teachers. I've spoken to several school superintendents, and they are very concerned and also wanting to know what to do next.
And you've written, and we'll touch on what you wrote in your book. We talked about your book a while back, but you say a lot of what we do in our schools to prevent and react to shootings is a lot of money that doesn't necessarily make anybody safer.
Absolutely. We can't fortify our way to safety. I spoke with superintendents this morning. They told me they have already received calls from vendors wanting to sell them safety products, such as window films, fences, metal detectors. And this is not the solution to school safety. We also have schools who want to screen, to potentially profile who's the next student who could become the school shooter. There is not a profile of a school shooter, but this is intense pressure placed upon superintendents and school leaders and school boards right now. They're just looking at what to do.
I see the phrase threat assessment coming up a lot when it comes to schools these days. They don't necessarily use the word profile. Is there a way to say, okay, can we figure out our next risk, our biggest risk, without it being in that so-called profiling category?
Sure. Well, absolutely. We don't want to profile, but threat reporting. And there's a term, leakage. Leakage is when residue is left online. Somebody makes a social media post that they were going to bring harm to the school, bring harm to themselves. Helping students with see something, say something. When I talk to superintendents, that's where they're putting their efforts right now, working with their staff, working with their students. If you identify something with a gut feeling, a tacit knowledge, your instinct, something that doesn't seem right, come forward and share that information.
On the other hand, so we've got these two incidents at schools we talked about. Also, there's reporting that there were four, you know, online threats. Don't come to school. There's going to be a shooting, or I'm going to do something. And sometimes it's just, you know, when we were teenagers, we sometimes said stupid stuff. How do we distinguish that from a real threat?
Right. Well, Rob, unfortunately, today it's a very thin line. We have to take every threat extremely seriously and investigate to a complete conclusion. So there isn't this leeway. You know, 30 years ago in Wisconsin, it was common for high school parking lots during deer hunting season to have gun racks, and students would have guns. The culture has changed, and we have to emphasize the point that in 75% of school shootings, somebody else knew, at least one other person knew. Multiple studies coming out and revealing that information. That's where we need to put our resources, because the shootings that have happened in the last few days, the mass shootings that are happening, they used to be 5 to 8 minutes. Rob, they're right now between 15 seconds and 60 seconds. So we've got to get on the threat identification side, because we're not going to be quick enough to fortify our way to safety when something unfolds this rapidly.
So say a school administrator or a teacher or a janitor, it can be sometimes, gets that tip from a student. Hey, I think so-and-so, they're making these threats. They're talking. I know they have firearms. What's the next step in that situation to evaluate and figure out what you do?
Right. Absolutely. If it is a threat of harm to self or others might involve firearms, that is an immediate call to the police. Also, the school, if there's concerns that a student might be presenting with depression, isolation. Schools do have counselors. They do have threat assessment teams, student wellness teams that then they can use to identify if the student needs additional resources from the community.
Right, because if you have that student in that borderline zone, if they do go forth and commit that shooting, that's one thing. How do you intervene before then, but in a way that you know, doesn't ruin that kid's life if they had that potential to turn things around?
Right. That's a terrific question. And we do have laws in place, FERPA, Privacy Act laws, which are very robust in protecting the identity of students. So if we're pairing up the resources, the mental health services, medical interventions for students, and making sure that our FERPA protections are intact, that usually goes a long way in making sure that we're meeting the needs of students without putting, I guess, a scarlet letter on them of, you know, once you've done this, how are you going to reintegrate into the school system, your community, your family, so forth. It's really tricky.
We're talking about school safety with David Perodin, professor at Viterbo University, author of the book School of Errors, Rethinking School Safety in America, after two police-involved shootings at Wisconsin high schools in the last couple days, looking at what schools can do to make sure kids stay safe. David, a big part of your book, I know, is talking about this idea of training students and staff in situational awareness. What does that look like?
Situational awareness is understanding what is happening around you at all times. And we can do this in very simple ways in schools, taking students around the campus. What did you hear? What did you smell? What did you see? What was different? Maybe put some things out that are a little atypical, the scent of oranges, for example. But activities like that, situational awareness. I was interviewing a caver from Lake Tahoe, who rescues people from caves, and he talked about his practice with situational awareness is simply watching people in public spaces and trying to anticipate what they do next. So there are many ways that we can get at this, but we don't have a movement toward that because vendors and marketers cannot sell you situational awareness. And we know that school safety is a $3 billion industry. So you're going to get marketed just as what's happening right now, school superintendents getting calls from vendors, let me sell you this because of two shootings in Wisconsin.
And what a lot of schools already are doing and maybe considering doing if they're not already is a mass shooter drill. What are we getting right or wrong when it comes to those?
What we get right is if we put objectives to those drills. Are we trying to identify the perimeter that will be around a school? Are two-way radios working? Have we communicated to parents not to rush to the school because then it makes it very difficult to get assets to the school? I know that was an issue with Waukesha. I talked to somebody who was on scene there. So those are the types of things we want to consider. What we get wrong with drills is when we go hyper-realistic, when we just terrify students and staff and introduce drill trauma, make kids afraid to go to school and staff terrified and parents terrified. That is not the response that is effective.
So a school administrator calls you, I don't know, after the show today and says, okay, we saw this in Waukesha, we saw this in Oshkosh, we're watching around the country. What are my next steps? What do you tell them?
Absolutely. So I got that question several times today. We've done this. What do we do next? And what you do next is you emphasize, see something, say something. You go back with all of your students at all levels, and you also introduce that to the student, to the parents. If you sense something isn't right that your child is saying or their friends are saying, that again, a gut instinct, bring it forward. Either report it to the counselor. If it's a threat of harm to self or others, report it to the police. But revisit. Go there right now. This isn't the time to check if you have bulletproof film on your windows or anything like that. See something, say something now.
How about dialing down the anxiety level for everybody involved? Because we see responses from teachers who are at these schools, students at these schools, and you know, kids in other schools are watching this and thinking, are we next? How do we prepare for these safety issues without ruining everybody's lives and making them scared all the
right.
time?
That's a tricky question because it's saturated on you know, media and on what they're reading, and the fact that, you know, this happens close by. People have been to, you know, Waukesha and Oshkosh, right? So what we need to do is to listen to students, give students a voice. It's called Youth Code of Silence. Do focus groups, allow students to tell you what they're feeling, allow parents to tell you what they're feeling. Your school counselors are great at this. Their school psychology organization, your school psychologist, NASP, has an excellent protocol for having those discussions of returning to school, having school be a safe place, and really empowering students. We want students to come forward and share information. That happens, Rob, a lot, and it's been recognized a lot lately. So that has been a successful model we need to put more steam behind.
I wanted to ask about the role of school resource officers, both central parts of the story in the Waukesha and Oshkosh cases here. What's your view of the role of the SRO, so-called?
So I think the SRO is a tremendous asset to a school district. I, of course, don't know anything in depth about what has happened in these two instances. With schools, it is a delicate balance with an SRO because some schools don't know where school discipline stops and SRO intervention begins. So I was talking with some people in Texas, and they were frustrated because in their schools, the SROs, for example, were the ones handling if a student didn't have their ID that day, and that really should have been an administrator. Do we really want an SRO to be contacting a student and have that relationship kind of frictional from that point of view? So I think there's a lot of work to be done on how SROs are trained, how they interact. Texas is doing that right now.
And getting back to your main idea, that see something, say something, and the situational awareness, again, you can't buy that stuff. How can schools train in that?
Sure. I wrote about it in my book. There are different activities. One is Kim's Game, where you have so many things on a table, you try to remember them, you recall them. Again, going around your environment, what's different, watching people, trying to predict what's next. This sounds super, right? Super easy. Mm-hmm. And it's actually very effective. We know that this works in military training snipers. It's been used in the Scouts for over 120 years. And again, we know that 75% of the time, per the National Threat Assessment Center in 2018, the most recent study, somebody else knew and didn't tell. So we need to have our kids be very aware of what's happening. They detect it. They bring it forward. We're not working on awareness, and we're not looking at the systems that identify the threats and how kids are reporting. We're not asking those questions.
David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Perodin, professor in the School of Education at Viterbo University in La Crosse, former school administrator, and author of the book School of Errors, Rethinking School Safety in America. We talked to them about various measures schools take to prevent school shootings and react to them when they happen.